From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a reason people still remember the name Joe Hill. Hill was a union activist, and his protest songs gave voice to the struggle between workers and management around the turn of the 20th century. But people remember him because of the way he died. He was convicted of the murder of a Utah grocer and was executed by a firing squad in Salt Lake City 100 years ago. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation with the writer William Adler, who's written a book about Joe Hill. It's about Hill's beliefs and his character, about the condition of working society in that time, but it's also about the murder that Hill is said to have committed, because Adler says he's found evidence Hill died a martyr, but also an innocent man. Join us after the news. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio inviting you to join us for the next screening in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. On Thursday, September 10th, we're showing the latest film by the director of The Cove. Luis Hoyos went underground to expose the trafficking of endangered species. But the film is also about the power of images to change the course of things. It's called Racing Extinction, and it's your first chance to see it since Sundance. That's Thursday, September 10th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In November of 1915, the state of Utah executed a labor organizer and leftist songwriter by the name of Joe Hill. Hill had been arrested and charged with killing a Salt Lake City grocer, and his legend has persisted for some reason. It may have to do with his music. He was one of the labor movement's most prominent songwriters. But one of the main reasons that people still remember Joe Hill is that he died a martyr. Hill maintained his innocence, but he never did testify for himself at his trial about the circumstances of that shooting. He didn't produce supporting witnesses, so it's fair to say he could have chosen to live, but the writer William Adler wanted to know why he didn't, what he could achieve by dying a martyr. William Adler has written a book exploring Joe Hill's life and the circumstances of the crime he was executed for committing. The book is called The Man Who Never Died. We spoke with Adler a few years ago. At the time, the Occupy Wall Street movement was in the news, so you'll hear a few references to that during the conversation. This Saturday, there's going to be a concert and a celebration of Joe Hill's life and work at Sugar House Park in Salt Lake City. We'll give you the details a little bit later in the program. I wanted to start how you do in the book, if you don't mind, with the funeral, because it kind of gives a sense of the man and, you know, puts the context of the time right up front. This is November 25th. It's Thanksgiving, as a matter of fact. It's in Chicago. Public funeral there. And it's a funeral the likes of which you say the city had never really seen. Paint that scene for us, if you will. There were hundreds and hundreds, thousands of people who came to the funeral of this man.
That's right. It was Thursday morning, Thanksgiving morning, as you say, and it was a warm day, and the funeral was held in a rented hall upstairs in a block-long building, and there were about 5,000 people who crowded into this hall, and they were jammed nook and cranny, shoulder to shoulder in there. But there were another 25 or 30,000 people outside on the streets. And when the people inside upstairs started singing Joe Hill's songs in tribute to their slain martyr, the folks outside would pick up the tune from these great open windows upstairs and start singing themselves. So there was a cacophony, this huge kind of street chorus singing Joe Hill's songs all over the west side of Chicago.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about that moment, and then you contrast it with the way I'm not sure how to put it. The establishment was sort of looking at all of these goings on. There's a reference from the New York Times you mention where this group was sort of referred to kind of as rabble, bums, hobos, of whom less than 10% were American. It's interesting sort of the way the establishment was seeing this funeral that was playing out in Chicago on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I think it actually was a little nervous because as the New York Times also editorialized on the day of his execution, which had been a week earlier in Salt Lake, The Times was afraid that a dead Joe Hill could be more dangerous to the status quo than a live Joe Hill, which is the same thing that Joe Hill was had started to theorize about in the days and weeks before he died.
It makes me think the scene of, and I'm wondering if you see the connections between the atmosphere then and the Occupy Wall Street movement. Critics, the establishment of the country, saw them, you describe it as this toxic brew of feckless ideology and reckless imagination. America's cancer sore is how some were describing it. America's most damnable enemy. You've got to see some connections to the way people are looking with some trepidation at Occupy Wall Street. Are you seeing something there?
I do. I see a lot of connections. It's really rather remarkable, the parallels. You know, for one thing, one of the Joe Hill's union was the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, or the Wobblies. And one of their great contentions was this great chasm between the haves and the have-nots, between the 1% and the 99%, essentially, which, of course, is the slogan of the occupiers. And they're also arguing that, you know, Wall Street has too much power over Congress, and they've controlled the elections. It's the same thing you would have heard a century ago is going on now, and people are in the streets again. It's quite striking.
Mm. One of the dynamics that makes this moment in time so interesting is music. The mass singing, because you say the act of mass singing seemed to kind of embolden and inspire all kinds of people. The singing, you say, went straight to their hearts. This was a powerful tool, I guess, for this movement.
I think it was, because you have to remember that back then so many workers, especially in the West, were immigrants, and they came from all sorts of places, spoke disparate languages, were varying ethnicities, and music was a way of uniting them. It brought people together. And if they couldn't necessarily share a common language, if they couldn't all read the same pamphlet, let's say, they could all understand the same music. They had heard a lot of these melodies, and that was one of the IWW's great inventions, essentially, or at least they popularized the use of using familiar melodies with and writing new words to those melodies, so people could pick up the tune and sing along fairly easily.
Hmm. They were irreverent, blunt, acerbic at times. There's a song that Joe Hill wrote, "The Preacher and the Slave," which is just a parody of the sort of the gospel song "Sweet By and By," and I wanted to play an excerpt of this song to give people a sense of it. Talk about this. I mean, it's pretty pretty snarky. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'm not sure they would have used that word, but they had their own colorful vocabulary a century ago. But yeah, I think it was. "The Preacher and the Slave" was probably Joe Hill's best song, in my opinion, and certainly his best known and most enduring song. And it was a direct evisceration of what he considered to be Christian hypocrisy, especially and specifically in the hands of the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
Which preached that you could work and pray, live on hay, as Joe Hill wrote, and wish for pie in the sky, but it wasn't like that according to Hill and the Wobblies, and so he wanted to write this song to counter that.
Mm. He renders the name Starvation Army, I think.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Now, here's a version of "Preacher and the Slave." This is performed by Harry McClintock.
Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked how about something to eat, they will answer with voices so sweet, "You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. Holy rollers and jumpers come out, and they sing and they clap and they shout. Give your money to Jesus, they say. He will cure all diseases today. And you will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. And the Starvation Army...
It makes me wonder, William Adler, what was Joe Hill's spiritual view? Did he believe in a God? Did he believe in, did he have a kind of spiritual religious sensibility to him? Because he's pretty skeptical, at least of the way religion is being handled. But did he have a kind of ideology that he believed?
Yeah, I mean, I think skeptical is putting it charitably.
Right.
He definitely had turned into an atheist by the time he wrote that song.
Sure.
Although he grew up in Sweden, when you grow up in Sweden in his day, he was born in 1879. You are born into the Church of Sweden, the state church, which was a strict Lutheran church. And yet his parents left that church when Joe Hill was very young and joined a revival movement that was sweeping the continent and also Sweden. And it was basically a free church movement. And that church preached a gospel of social justice, which, unlike the Lutheran church, the state church, I think educated Hill and his family about some of the important issues that were going on. And so Hill embraced that initially, as his parents did, and his parents also sang in the church choir there. So Joe Hill developed a love of music and a sense of dissidence, I think, at an early age. And I think that carried over when he began writing songs in this country.
Well, his attitude toward the Salvation Army came from back home. His father died and the Salvation Army didn't offer any help.
That's right. His father had been a railroad conductor. He died in an industrial accident when Hill was 8 years old. And that left his family, his mother, with six children under the age of 12. And that was pretty tough. And there was not a great welfare state in Sweden at that point. And you basically would beg for alms. Among the organizations that did occasionally dole out charitable money was the Salvation Army. They didn't get any money from the Salvation Army. They got a little bit of money from the city, and his mother got a small widow's pension from the railroad. But there were many days when that family had nothing to eat. And in fact, his sister later recalled finding a sack of old potatoes on the road and dragging it home, and that fed the family for a couple of days. But it really was very tough, very impoverished boyhood for him once his father died.
The thing that I wondered about, and we're going to sort of work through how the IWW, their kind of dogma or their ideology, because in some ways, I guess it's fair to say that this became Joe Hill's religion in many ways. But it wasn't a utopian view necessarily. It seemed more – is it fair to say it seemed more pragmatic, more practical than that?
Well, you know, it was partly a utopian view, I think, because, I mean, there was the rhetoric of the IWW and there was the reality.
Yeah.
And the reality was that they were really interested in agitating for higher wages, better working conditions, safer working conditions, and to be treated with some dignity and respect in the workplace. The rhetoric, on the other hand, was promoting what they called an industrial democracy, which was basically a state where workers controlled the means of production. I mean, it was a Marxian view, although Big Bill Haywood, who was one of the founders of the IWW and who chaired the original organizing convention in 1905, said that he had never read Marx, but that he had the marks of capital all over him. I thought that was a pretty good way of putting it, because I don't think a lot of the members necessarily read Marx, but they did have a kind of a utopian view about this world. Socialism with its working clothes on is another way that Haywood described what the industrial democracy could be.
Your introduction to to Joe Hill. Let me play another song, because this seems to be your way in to Joe Hill. This is there are a few versions of the song Joe Hill. I'd say my favorite is this Paul Robeson version. But it seems, if I understand it properly through your book, this was kind of your way in. This is the thing that got you thinking about Joe Hill. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say. I mean, I had known that song for a long time, but I didn't really know how much of that song was fact, how much fiction. And it wasn't until I read Bob Dylan's memoir back in 2005, I think it had come out the previous year, in which Dylan devotes several pages in the book to Joe Hill and what an influence Hill had been on Woody Guthrie, and in turn what an influence Guthrie had been on Dylan and other, you know, later generations of political songwriters, that it really got me thinking that Hill was this kind of cornerstone of American protest music, about which and about whom I knew next to nothing, and I wanted to learn more. But yes, it was the song that really was the original catalyst.
Here it is. This is sung by Paul Robeson.
In Salt Lake City, just as I am standing by my bed, they framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead, says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe, they shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die.
It's Paul Robeson. What do you like about that song? I mean, it's a folk hero. It's a story of a myth. It's this martyred character. I mean, is that what caught you? Is the myth of this man?
I think that was a part of it. And as I said, I didn't really know where the myth started and the man stopped. Yeah. And that intrigued me about it. But it's, I guess it's just one of those classic American folk songs that I always knew a little bit about, but not very much about. And for some reason, this one grabbed me.
Why does the legend of Joe Hill endure, do you think? I mean, that's an important question that you work throughout the book.
Yeah. I think in part it is because he had to answer this really profound question that very few of us would ever ask ourselves, which is that if a cause is important enough to live for, is it also worth dying for? And it was his answer to the question, I think, that established him as a hero in his time of working class resistance and courage and rebellion. And then once he did decide he was going to go through with martyrdom, he was going to allow the Utah firing squad to execute him, that I think that really cemented his fame and his legend.
The historian William Adler. His book is called The Man Who Never Died, The Life, Times, and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. Tomorrow there's a concert and a celebration of Joe Hill's life and work at Sugar House Park in Salt Lake City. We should also mention a six-part series the Salt Lake Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley has created on the life of Joe Hill. It's running throughout the week. You can find details for all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER.
If you all set your trap, I will tell you about a chap who was broken up against a 2-4 fare. He was not the kind to shirk. He was looking hard for work, and he heard the same old story everywhere. Tramp, 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 keep on a-trampin'. There's nothing doing here for you. If I catch you round again, you will wear the ball and chain. So just keep on trampin', the best thing you can do.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the story of Joe Hill. He was a beloved union activist and a songwriter whose music gave voice to the tumultuous labor movement in the early part of the 20th century. He was executed by a firing squad in Salt Lake City 100 years ago, for the murder of a Utah grocer. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation that we had a few years back with the historian William Adler. He's written a book about Joe Hill. It's called The Man Who Never Died. Let's talk about the Wobblies, the IWW. You talk about in the book how this is the country's most reviled, on one hand, also most revered labor organization. And I guess we call them a union, but in some ways they were not really a union. They were kind of this loose conglomeration of these incredibly disparate groups and types and people.
That's right. They were a union, I suppose, in name and name only. They didn't believe in, for instance, traditional labor practices even then of collective bargaining agreements or negotiations or anything like that. And they didn't believe in that because they didn't believe in it was possible to reform the capitalist system of wage slavery, as they put it. They believed in revolution. And we spoke a few minutes ago about the their aim for an industrial democracy. Workers working for the benefit of themselves and other workers and not for their capitalist bosses. And so in that sense, they weren't a union. And they were, in a sense, as Wallace Stegner put it, a fighting faith, the shock troops of labor. I always liked that that phrase because they really were. They went out and they were kind of the first line of in the radical, I guess, the radical wing of the labor movement. They were out there front and center.
Fighting faith, but it was also a movement that did believe in nonviolent resistance. So where did the idea of action come into play? What was the idea of revolution? What was the concept that they and the means that they figured they would get there?
Right. Well, they believed in the concept of direct action as opposed to, say, parliamentary action or electoral reform, again, because they didn't think you could tinker with the machinery of capitalism. You had to destroy it. Mm. And direct action was any sort of action right in the workplace, right where it affected workers directly or perhaps in the street. So they really pioneered the use of sit-down strikes and sit-ins, things you would see later on in the labor movement, in the civil rights movement, in the anti-war movements. And also in slowdown strikes, and they called all of that sabotage, but it wasn't the sort of sabotage necessarily where, you know, you would think of destroying a piece of equipment or anything like that. You would try to slow down the works, and that was one of their ways of resistance, one of their ways of direct action.
Was it an effective strategy?
I think in the short term it was. Yeah, I mean there were times when, particularly, I'm thinking of in the period right before World War I and in the lead up to World War I in 1917, the IWW started a series of slowdowns, work stoppages, and slowdowns at copper producing facilities in the West, in Butte, Montana, down in Bisbee, Arizona. And they were so effective that it really provoked the government into clamping down on the union and passing a series of laws, state laws and then federal laws, basically outlawing the IWW. So, yeah, I'd have to say it was effective.
The American West at this time in the country's history was, as you put it in the book, a virtual colony. I mean, it was based on natural resources, but operated mostly by interests in the country's east. And the prevailing attitude, you quote the historian Patricia Limerick, who said, you know, it was basically get in, get rich, and get out. That's like they were American serfs almost.
I guess that's a good way of putting it. They really were. That was one difference in the way the economy had been shifting at the turn of the 20th century. You know, clearly we were past this period of Jeffersonian agrarianism. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't necessarily inexorably yet on the path to modern industrial capitalism. And this was a raw and brutal time, especially in the West and in those extractive industries. And I think it was really up for grabs. And one of the things that surprised me in doing the research was just how seriously socialism was taken as a legitimate alternative, economic alternative at that time. And it really was seen as a detour around the inequities of capitalism by millions of people. I'm thinking, You know, the 1912 presidential election, Eugene Debs drew almost a million votes. There were socialist mayors in major American cities.
18 of them.
Yeah, that's right. And in Utah especially, there were quite a few socialists elected all over the state. So it was really a fascinating time for me. And this book, this, you know, this trial on Joe Hill opened up this vast portal that I really knew little bit about this period in American history.
Well, it's so hard to imagine it today. I mean, socialism is such a byword in American politics today, no matter where you stand almost. But in those days, you say for lots and lots of Americans, it wasn't alien. It wasn't from, you know, a place that came from a foreign concept or un-American. It seemed to make some sense.
Exactly. It wasn't some kind of subversive plot, as people would talk about today. It was legitimate, as I say, and I think, you know, if the economy wasn't quite up for grabs, and if socialism wasn't necessarily looming on the near horizon, it was certainly a possibility at that point for many millions of people.
The issue at hand, you write about, was, again, and this is the same kind, it seems, of motivation that's driving the Occupy Wall Street movement. It's this issue of economic inequality. One study you mentioned found in 1915 one-third to one-half of the population living at near starvation levels, and then 2% of Americans owned 60% of the nation's wealth. I think you can draw some correlations, for some people do anyway, in terms of the same similar kinds of connections to today. But it was this idea of economic inequality that was fueling a lot of these attitudes.
Right. Economic inequality and certainly the pronounced concentration of wealth. And you point out those statistics, and I don't have today's statistics in front of me, but I know they're similar, if not even more pronounced today than they were a century ago, which is a little hard to fathom, but I believe is true. And so, you know, one question I've had is, what took so long? I mean, why is this Occupy movement just gaining strength now? And what are some of the root causes behind it? And that's, you know, maybe that's a whole nother book. But it fascinates me to study these parallels.
But look at the roots. I mean, here's something that you write. You write about the struggles over a new economic order, rising inequality, the myth of a classless society, the limits of dissent and free speech, the causes and consequences of radical thought, the danger to democracy of a compliant and sensational press, the right to due process of law, the separation of church and state. I mean, it goes on and on. The meaning of patriotism, the use of economic power to leverage political power. I mean, these are the things that are happening today. I mean, it's completely relevant in a lot of ways. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it is that. And also that the other thing I found interesting, and this was starting back more closer to the beginning of the year before the Occupy movement started, but when the state legislature and the governor in Wisconsin started cracking down on public employees, and I began thinking about those parallels between how unions today and immigrants today, for that matter, are being scapegoated just as they were in Joe Hill's day. And, you know, never mind deregulation on Wall Street or deindustrialization or tax loopholes for wealthy and for corporations. No, it was the cops and the firefighters and the teachers who were being blamed in Wisconsin and elsewhere for America's economic woes.
Let's take a call. Pat is with us in Salt Lake City. Pat, welcome.
Thank you, Doug.
Sure.
My grandfather actually knew the grocer who had also been the chief of police in Murray and was disliked by most union people. My grandfather was a railroad engineer, and then he also knew Joe Hill. Didn't ever believe he was guilty. But my question is, his 100th anniversary of the execution that happened in what's now Sugar House Park will occur in 2015. And I wondered if your guests would have any suggestions as to how that should be memorialized. Some of us have been talking about building a monument. We've talked to the AFL-CIO. They're interested. But it would also be a good chance for Utah's artistic community to express something 100 years later. But I wonder if he had any thoughts after all of his research.
Pat, stay with us. William Adler, what do you think? I mean, how dicey would it be to raise a monument to Joe Hill in the current political context?
Well, I think in some ways it would be appropriate to do so. I think it's long overdue in Salt Lake City. And I think if the research in this book has shown anything, it should certainly suggest Hill's innocence. And, you know, one other thing people have suggested to me along the way is the possibility of starting a campaign, Pat, that might lead to a posthumous exoneration of Joe Hill. Whether that would take an act of the state legislature or a gubernatorial act, I don't know. But that might be something that folks in Utah might want to consider aiming for as the centenary gets closer in 2015.
Well, Pat, do you have any feelers out there? Are you getting any resistance to?
Well, being the optimist that I am, I would imagine that getting an exoneration would be about the same chances of having the Utah legislature draw fair lines on the congressional districts. So maybe my great-grandchildren might have some shot at that. I think amongst the younger population, one of the concerns that I think the guest book will raise is with young people and their belief or disbelief increasingly in whether or not the system actually works, which I think is going to be one of the biggest challenges that the next two or three decades are going to represent. We seem to have been on autopilot for a long time. And books like this, I think, bring us back to earlier parts in our history where the system was challenged and through direct action was, you know, saved, if you will.
Pat, we're glad you called.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. We should also say that there was a clear difference, William Adler, between the IWW and other labor movements, the American Federation, I think, of Labor is one example. Some movements sort of saw themselves as having kind of a collaborative relationship with industry and with government. The IWW wasn't about that. They want, I think, as you've said, they wanted something separate.
They did. The American Federation of Labor, which had been around since the 1880s and was, of course, the established and establishment labor federation in the country at that point, was run with an iron grip by Samuel Gompers, its president. And Gompers was in close touch with presidential administrations, and he saw himself and the AFL as a full partner, a collaborator, with both business and government. And that could not have been farther from the ideology and philosophy of the IWW. The AFL preached a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, but the IWW didn't believe in pay.
Right.
It didn't believe in wage slavery, as I said earlier, and so.
But wait, explain that. Yeah. What was the concept that someone would be paid under this idea?
Well, that workers would run the factories for themselves, and that if anybody produced something in a factory, they would share in those profits. That they wouldn't just be paid a wage set by a capitalist, that the money would be shared, the fruit of their labor would be theirs, basically. And again, it was kind of a utopian, I hesitate to say pie in the sky, thought, but that's what the IWW philosophy was all about, and that's what they really aimed for. They aimed high.
They aimed high. Any remnants of the Wobblies in today's labor force at all? Do you see anything left from that concept?
Well, for one thing, the industrial workers of the world is still around. And in fact, it never disappeared entirely. It's ebbed and flowed and mostly ebbed in the days since Joe Hill. But it is indeed back today. And it's a union that actually now does believe in collective bargaining. But it's been organizing actively in the fast food industries across the country and has actually made some inroads. So they're back. But as far as the revolutionary philosophy goes, I would say there isn't really much in the way of remnants anymore.
This idea of organizing into one general organization, one big union, that's where another Joe Hill song, Workers of the World Awaken. Solidarity, I guess, was the point here, that's the essential power in dealing with industry was solidarity, that we could do this, but we all have to come together. I mean, that I guess that's a basic concept in a lot of labor organizations, but one big union, that was sort of the ideal for Joe Hill and others of the time.
That's right, and that's another distinction between the IWW and the AFL, which created, I don't know how many thousands of locals and individual unions within the same industry, so that, say, in the steel industry, you'd have people organized in all sorts of different locals, the engineers and the people who worked in the shop, the brakemen. And so if one union struck, it didn't necessarily mean another one would strike, and there wasn't necessarily any sort of solidarity among those unions. So it was really tough to achieve any kind of power. And the IWW believed that everybody in the steel industry should be organized under the same umbrella of the one big union, the IWW.
William Adler, his book is called The Man Who Never Died. So you heard during that segment of the program a question about how Joe Hill's death 100 years ago should be memorialized. Well, tomorrow there's a concert and a celebration of Joe Hill's life and legacy at Sugar House Park. We have details about that on our website. There's also a link to Salt Lake Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley's serialized take on Joe Hill's life. You can find all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER.
Play, go wild, simply wild over me. Although I've never done them harm that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation about the labor icon Joe Hill. We had with us on the program William Adler, who's written a book about Hill's beliefs and his character, also about the working conditions of the time. The book is called The Man Who Never Died. We should also mention that at the time we first broadcast this conversation, the Occupy Wall Street movement was in the news, so from time to time you'll hear references to that during the conversation. Let's take a call from Moab, Utah. Jonna is with us. Jonna, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
You posed the question just a little earlier in the program, why it took so long for a group like the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street movement to happen, given all of the situations you were talking about. And I would like to just suggest that there's always been sort of the buffer of the large middle class in this country that, has caused the buffer. It's caused that buffer between capitalism and labor, and that perhaps that's no longer as applicable as it once was, given the economic situation.
You mean there's no longer that many in the middle class to be the buffer?
Yeah, exactly.
William Adler, what do you think?
I think John is onto something there. That's a good point. I mean, the level of joblessness is up. I think the level of despair is up accordingly. And I think people have just had enough. And I think with the bank bailouts a couple of years ago, that certainly was a spur as well. And I think that anger has been building. I think a lot of people didn't take it seriously at first when it just first broke out on Wall Street itself. But it as it has spread around the country to towns large and small, I think people now are sensing that there is some real depth to this movement, and I think it may last for a while.
Jonna, thanks very much. Well, a good part of the book, of course, is the crime for which Joe Hill was arrested, convicted, executed. He had been executed by Utah for the murder of a grocer in Salt Lake City, a fellow by the name of John Morrison, former police officer, father of six. You say the evidence that the state presented against him early in the book, you say wispy, wasn't a terribly strong case, I guess, is the point.
No, maybe wispy was too strong a word. there was no direct evidence against Hill whatsoever in this case. The only bit of circumstantial evidence was introduced at the trial was that Hill had the misfortune of being shot through the chest on the same night that Mr. Morrison and his 17-year-old son, Arling, were both murdered by two assailants who burst into their store just before closing time. It was the night of Saturday, January 10th, 1914, when those murders occurred and when Hill was shot.
We should say the clincher, or one of the clinchers anyway, the fact that he was shot in the chest was a big thing too. But he also happened to have in his pocket the red IWW Union card, which didn't exactly help his case, I guess.
No, it didn't help his case. But as we'll see, Hill didn't really help his case himself.
No, that's the most important part. But yeah, that's right.
There were many times he probably could have helped his case. I think due to a combination of naivety about the criminal justice system, and his own stubbornness and cockiness, and some other things as well down the road, I think Hill indeed sabotaged his own case, and the result may not have been as it turned out had he done made some different strategical moves earlier in his case.
What brought him to Salt Lake City in the first place?
Well, he had been working and organizing on the docks in Southern California in the Los Angeles Harbor. And when he was out there, he met two men from Murray. And they were fellow Swedes, and none of them had been able to find sustained work on the docks, due in part to a strike that the Wobblies had organized, in which, in fact, Hill was the secretary of the strike committee. It was an ill-fated strike. It was broken after about 3 days. And after that, the hiring halls, which were controlled by the American Federation of Labor, blacklisted Wobblies, members of the IWW. And so Hill and his friends were left without a means of income. And so his friends from Murray invited him and another friend with whom he'd been living in this tar paper shack right on the docks of the harbor, invited them back to Utah to find work. And so he arrived in Salt Lake in the middle of August of 1913, and that was about 4.5 months, 5 months before he was arrested for the murder of John Morrison.
I wondered, was there something about the Mormon culture, Mormon beliefs, that appealed to Joe Hill, at least initially? I mean, Mormons have a deep history of, you know, collective living, communal ideals. I mean, the church became pretty critical of unionism in that era, or was becoming anyway. But I'm wondering, did he have any affinity with Mormons in some ways?
You know, I don't know that he did. I do know that the Mormons had been organizing and recruiting members in his hometown in Sweden at the time of his birth. And so he was probably familiar with Mormonism from then. And, you know, they were another kind of dissident group in terms of the Church of Sweden, and they were seen as threats to the church. So in that sense, maybe yes. But I think by the time he got to Utah, the church, certainly as the IWW portrayed the church in its literature, were supporters and bastions of capitalism, and the church really seemed at odds with, as you say, with any sort of organized labor, let alone radical wing of labor like the Wobblies.
There was a where in the way the trial played out, where did the LDS Church fit in that? I mean, there was this clear sense by many of Joe Hill's supporters that the church was complicit in some kind of, you know, conspiracy in the murder of Joe Hill. You mentioned a fellow by the name of Orrin Hilton, who was a labor advocate and a lawyer, called the church a mighty empire, a hideous, slimy monster.
He did have a way with words, didn't he? That was, that's right. And Hilton, Orrin Hilton, was Hill's appellate attorney. Yeah. He had come from Denver to represent Hill. He had been a lawyer for the Western Federation of Miners, which was another radical union back then. And that was, those words were Hilton's. He spoke them at Hill's funeral in Chicago. Right. And there was that sense by the IWW, fanned by the IWW, that the Mormon Church was really at the center of some conspiracy to railroad Joe Hill to his death. I don't think that was at all the case. I think there was an understanding. It was an oligarchy, certainly, in Utah, and I think there was an understanding that didn't need to be written down or conspired or anything like that. It was just known. I mean, it was, you know, the code. I mean, it was the press. It was politicians. It was the criminal justice system. It was employers, and there was so much interlocking interest in Utah at that time between the church and members of all those organizations. That I don't think there was any sort of grand conspiracy spelled out, per se, to Railroad Hill.
You know, it's interesting how long the idea that he was probably guilty, something was fishy anyway, persisted for years and years. I mean, you mentioned Wallace Stegner, who said that he probably was guilty, and a lot of others who have written said, well, it's not really clear, there's not enough evidence, we don't really know. At what point, when you were working on all of this, did you figure, wait a minute, he's not guilty at all, he's innocent?
Well, about a year into the research, and I spent about 5 years on this book, about a year into it, I concluded that there was another suspect. The initial primary suspect seemed to be, there was a much stronger circumstantial case that could have been made, should have been made against him than was made against Hill. And once I began to understand that, it seemed to me there was a strong likelihood of Hill's innocence. And then I found further documentation that supported Hill's innocence. But initially, I was working on the murder case itself. I wanted to kind of take a look at it as a cold case and just sort of put on my gumshoe hat and see what I could find out about this other suspect. And what I found out basically led me to believe in his guilt, in this other man's guilt, and therefore in Hill's innocence.
Hmm. I'm not sure how much you want to give away about that part, but this character, a fellow by the name of Frank Wilson, he's seen sort of hanging around near Morrison's grocery store. The police did, in fact, detain him at some point. Had a long rap sheet, had a bunch of different aliases. In the end, they let him go. Why?
Well, that was a curious thing. I mean, he did seem to fit the profile of a killer. The Salt Lake police, though, that didn't know very much about him and didn't make an effort to know very much about him. Yeah. They did know that under that name, Frank Wilson, he had served time in the Utah penitentiary for armed robbery, but that he'd been out for a year and a half. They also knew that he'd been seen in town on the day of the murder, and then after the murders, he was seen acting strangely, as some passersby put it, lying on the sidewalk on a, you know, there wasn't snow falling at the time, but there was snow on the ground. It was sub-freezing. So he was about a mile from the store about 90 minutes after the murders, lying down when he was seen. Then he hopped on a trolley car and came back to the scene of the murder and was seen by police when he was detained, wandering around the very block of the murder scene. And when they asked him where he lived and where he worked, he gave phony answers, but they didn't really check them out. And then they found a bloody handkerchief in his pocket, which would seem to be, you know, a clue that something was amiss.
Yeah.
But they didn't really follow up on that either. And then it was 2 days later, after the governor of Utah, William Spry, had posted a $500 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrators, that Hill was arrested. And he was arrested because the doctor to whom he had gone on that same night of the murders with his gunshot wound through the chest, called up the police and said, "Hey, I think I might have your guy. I've got a guy with a gunshot wound on that night." Mm. And the reason I say that is because it was the theory of the police at the time that the younger Morrison, Arling Morrison, who also died in the moments before he was murdered, had fired a shot at one of the two assailants and indeed had wounded the assailant. Again, that was the police and the prosecutor's theory, and so therefore that Hill must have been the man they wounded. There were plenty of problems with that theory, but that was the theory.
Well, it's an important part of the book, this story that you work through, an intriguing letter that you find in an attic in Michigan, I think it is, which tells a bigger story. But it all leads to this really principal question. I mean, Joe Hill could have spoken out. He could have mentioned the names of people who could have corroborated his alibi, but he didn't, and which just leads you to the idea, as we talked about earlier, he was determined to die and determined to die a martyr.
Yeah, I think he came, though, to that position gradually.
Yeah.
He was in prison for 22 months between the time he was arrested and the time he was executed. And during that time, after he was sentenced to death, so that would have been in the summer of 1914, that was when the IWW initiated this global campaign to try to spare Hill's life and to put pressure on the state of Utah. And what they did was generate something on the order of 40,000 letters and telegrams and petitions to the governor's office demanding or requesting, depending on the tone of the letter, that the governor spare Hill's life. And so I think in the end, that made Hill see himself in this same heroic light. And once he did that, I think he was ready to die.
William Adler, his book is called The Man Who Never Died, The Life, Times, and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. Tomorrow, there is a concert and a celebration of Joe Hill's life and work at Sugar House Park in Salt Lake City. We should also mention there's a 6-part series in the Salt Lake Tribune created by cartoonist Pat Bagley. It's about the life of Joe Hill. It runs throughout the week. You can find details on all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. ¶¶